Hello, everyone. Hi, I'm Madge Dresser, and I'm from the University of the West of England, as you can see. And I wanted to thank you all for showing up, because I know there are a lot of other really good papers competing for your attention, and I wanted to thank the Historical Association for asking me to talk. And what I'm going to do is, don't worry, I'm not going to read this all at once, but I'll just get going with a bit of a narrative, and then I'll be guided by the images that I'm going to show you. But I take it you've all read the abstract, so you sort of know more or less what I'm going to be talking about. And I'm looking at rethinking the agenda for the teaching of Black British history, and particularly in relationship to the history of slavery. Now, can you all hear me? All right? Okay, good. Okay. The theme is certainly timely. There are two conferences in October 2015. One was called Putting the Black Back in Union Jack, which was organized by the University of London's Legacy of Slave Ownership, and another conference called What's Happening in Black History, which was convened by the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. And as we speak, David Olushoga, a well-known TV presenter and producer, is preparing a BBC series on the black presence in Britain. And just after delivering this paper, I'm going up to the Georgian House just up Park Street here to be interviewed for a Radio 4 series on the same topic presented by Gretchen Gierzina. So it seems like it's a very topical subject. So when I was first invited to present this paper, I thought I was competent to talk to you about it. But now that I have had more time to reflect, I'm not so sure, because if the Historical Association's brief is to provide, quote, solutions to history teachers and departments to help them meet their training and development needs, end quote, I may be singularly ill-equipped to fulfill such a brief, because although I know about Michael Gove's recasting of the way history is taught, and I've read Sir Richard Evans and Tristram Hunt and David Cannadine about the history wars and followed the fallout over the attempted exclusion of Mary Seacole from the national curriculum, I'm not well-versed in the details of the national curriculum, or indeed au fait with all the innovative practice at the cutting edge of teaching black history in schools. And I'm sure some of you are more knowledgeable about your specific practice than I am. So I come here humbly and to say that my expertise is at once more eclectic and abstract. I'm a university lecturer, so I've written about the history of slavery as it relates to mainland Britain. I've looked at the history of Bristol slave trade, the hidden history of London's commemorative statuary and its slavery links, the slaving connections of British country houses, which has just come out in a co-edited book that you can get online for free without the pictures via the English Heritage site. And I've also written on slavery and popular memory. And I also led an HLF project that finished in 2007 on 1,000 years of the history of Bristol's ethnic minorities as part of the England's Pass for Everyone project. So I've been interested in this area for a very long time. And I was also a founder member of the Bristol Black Archives Project, which was funded by the HLF. But what I want to do specifically today is to reflect on some of the issues and concerns around the conceptualization and teaching of black history as I encountered them in the course of my own research and community outreach work. So let's go here. I just thought that it's so timely, and the whole idea of black British history should be taught in British schools. We shall see. This is a great, in considering what happened last night, who knows what's going to happen. Right. So I want to look at how we define black history. I don't want to spend too much time on that. I want to look at some of the problems and opportunities of teaching black history through the history of slavery. I'm going to look at the American civil rights approach as a means into black history, and then look at the black presence and the use of visual sources. And I want to really drive home the importance and the challenges of thinking locally, but within a global context, and try to appreciate the kind of interaction between local place and global perspectives, and to talk about some local initiatives that I think are important, but I'm sure you probably know many more. So just defining black history, do we really mean black African diaspora history? And then does that mean we conflate people who are from the Caribbean or from those who are West African? And increasingly, some of the people you'll teach will be from the West African area. What about people of mixed heritage, as we call them now? And do we call South Asians black? In the 80s, that was the fashion. It was a political thing that black history was about Asians and African Caribbeans. I think that's probably out of fashion now and lacks the specificity we need to look at the complexities of Asian culture. And should there even be such a thing as a black history? If we mainstream it and try to integrate black history into wider history, we risk what we did to women's history when we made it into gender history, and that is to lose it, lose the specificity of it, and also the kind of immediacy that it has, particularly for students from black backgrounds. And if we don't mainstream it and teach it separately, do we risk ghettoizing it and racially essentializing it? There are all sorts of problems about that. I think engendering a sense of belonging when we teach black history is really important, both amongst white and black students. But as Sir Richard Evans has said, history is not a citizenship course. It's an academic subject in its own right. And I really want to urge one of my sort of passions, and it's perhaps unfashionable, is the need for really good scholarship. Use and utilize and exploit your universities and people who have the time to do this when you popularize history, those of you who are in the classroom and teaching. Use us, because you don't want to popularize on the basis of bad history. I think that does nobody any favors at all. So what about the ways that we can approach black history? Well, teaching black history through slavery, there's lots I could say about this. First of all, the idea of just teaching black history as the history of slavery is very depressing and reductionist, particularly for black pupils. Some years ago, I was chairing a session with Yasmin Alibi Brown and black parents in Bristol about this very subject, and the parents were just sort of saying how their children get turned off black history just because it's a very, very painful subject and to teach about victimhood. And I kind of relate to that, because the whole idea of teaching Jewish history through the Holocaust is similarly depressing. And so there's this whole idea of casting black people into the role of victim, and we need to challenge and question that. But there are problems associated with that. Some parents, black parents particularly, have been inclined, in order to counter this kind of depressing approach to history, to embrace uncritical and racially essentialist portrayals of the past, which focused on histories of great queens and kings, and there's a whole debate around that, in ascribing African ancestry to the Egyptian pharaohs, et cetera, which opens up a whole other area of historical debate, or seeing slavery strictly in terms of racial divides and not as a question that includes, yes, race, but also power, gender, and social class. And I think we have to look at slavery as the exploitation of human beings by one another, not forgetting the specifically racialist impact it's had at a specific time. There's a whole world of politically motivated websites where conspiracy theories abound, some of them anti-Semitic, and which incorporate outdated elitist Victorian approaches to history, you know, the great kings and queens of history, to produce an emotionally appealing but intellectually bankrupt version of the past. On the other hand, the very fact that these extremist or romanticized sites exist tells you about a need for re-interrogating black history, and sometimes they have stimulated a much-needed re-examination of conventional approaches to history, which tend often to be very celebratory about white anti-slavery attitudes, etc. So when addressing black history through the medium of the history of slavery, it's important to focus on class as well as racial oppression. The class issue is an elephant in the room, if you like, because it's important, because white pupils will often use it as an excuse to be alienated about the whole theme about slavery, because if you omit the by exclusively focus on black suffering, they will rightly fault omissions about the exploitation of white labor at the same time. And they will wrongly conclude that whites suffered as much as blacks during the slavery era, or that the volume of indentured servants and people forced, white people forced to serve as political prisoners or indentured servants on the plantations as virtual slaves was the same in terms of legal status and suffering as the and numbers as what happened to the people of African descent. So anyone who is looking at slavery has to acknowledge the fact that there were, as well as black enslaved people, wage slaves, and also some white people who were, you know, forcibly transported in the early days of the 17th century to serve as forced labor. But their legal status was different, and the sheer volume of numbers of Africans is much, much bigger than the white people who were forcibly transported. And it's really important. On the other hand, you need to be even-handed to look at these connections and the important differences between the exploitation of poor whites and black people. So, and also there are fascinating parallels, which I think need to be developed, between the attitudes and violent tactics, say, of agricultural workers participating in the swing riots, English agricultural workers participating in the 1830s in the swing riots, who maimed animals and did, you know, did all sorts of violent things, and the very similar attitudes happening amongst slaves resisting the Caribbean enslavement at the same time. And often the violence that they showed was used as a excuse by pro-slavery elements to sort of say, well, that's the way black people act, and they're racially inferior and they're prone to violence, when white workers were doing very similar things because of similar economic exploitation. Now, some teachers might take a different attitude towards slavery and look not at essentialist romanticizing of black resistance, but on they might tend to concentrate on abolition and anti-slavery and completely forget that, say, the Quakers, for example, who are so important in the anti-slavery movement, for 100 years before that, were often involved in the slave trade as traders, people excluded from the political establishment. And black essentialist groups like Legale have justifiably, in my view, resented the tendency during 2007 to treat the ending of the slave trade in Britain as a Wilberfest, a celebration of Wilberforce. And they make the point which Harriet Beecher Stowe, of all people, made in the 1850s, namely that a lot of abolitionists harbored racialist views towards blacks. So we mustn't romanticize the abolitionists either. So Legale and many others have preferred instead of celebrating the white abolitionists, they wanted to consider, when they're looking at the end of the slave trade and the end of slavery, which happened in 1838, to stress the role of African resistance and African agency. And that's fair enough, and it's a good counterpoint. However, there are dangers here too, and one is to romanticize the subject and to portray every enslaved African as a politically engaged and reflectively conscious freedom fighter, and every white, male, female, rich or poor, as equally and unadulteratedly evil. And that causes one to miss the opportunity to discuss the brutalization of slavery on both groups and the complexity of the relationship which bound them together, both literally and metaphorically. I think sometimes drama can be a good way of addressing these really complicated issues. And I think I've got a slide here on a play called Muscovado, which is doing a tour, which is set in Barbados in 1815, which I think effectively explores those themes. I'll get to that in a minute. There are three other opportunities to unpack the history of slavery and to relate it to the history of the black presence are these. The first is to consider the underdevelopment of the Caribbean after slavery and how that kind of developed and related to new Commonwealth immigration in the 1960s. What's the relationship between enslavement and new Commonwealth immigration? I think one of the most underrated or understudied things that teachers really should know about is the Moyne Commission, which was a royal commission which was called in 1938 to investigate agricultural unrest in the Caribbean. And the findings were so explosive, it wasn't publicized till after the war, wasn't made public. And what it showed was that in the Caribbean, not only were there hardly, well, virtually no colleges, very few secondary schools, the fact that many agricultural workers were living in the houses of the former slaves, the same quarters, but that the actual real wages of agricultural workers in the late 1930s was the same in real terms as those of the newly emancipated slaves in 1838. So you have exploitation and slavery and all sorts of repression as a direct legacy of slavery, which helped to propel the young and more adventurous people in the new Commonwealth to go to Britain in the first place. So I think there's this continuity of economic underdevelopment that really needs to be acknowledged and explored. The second thing is, I think, the importance of taking students here to places in the locale, in their neighborhood, in their area, statues, houses, industrial archaeological sites, and relate them to the Atlantic slave economy, to make something in their environment actually, you know, unpack it with them and to sort of show the links. And slavery trails are one example of that, and I think I've got an example or two in a minute. And the third opportunity or approach is to utilize family history. And this is quite a delicate subject, but I'll be talking about that, which family histories which connect people to their Caribbean or African past. Linking with local family history sources may yield unexpected results, and I'll talk about that as we go along. This was a HLF booklet that was partly predicated on some research I've done on Bristol, but which I. Although I had to sort of disassociate myself at the last minute from it, in the sense that some of the facts were not quite right, and that there is this problem of popular history being funded in a rush with deadlines and people cutting corners and not getting it quite right. But on the whole, I think the tone of this book was really good in that it examined slavery history in terms not just of the chronology of past events, but how it related to Bristol today, the feelings that unleashed in people. And we have to think of who we're teaching. We have to look at the different constituencies that we're teaching in terms of the students. I mean, it's going to be a very different experience for white students than for some black students and students of mixed heritage. And so it looks at facts, feelings, and myths and addressing some of the stuff that's on the internet that needs to be debunked. And so I think, you know, that kind of approach that looks at history more holistically, and I'm sure I don't have to tell you, those of you who are teachers here, about this, is quite important. I couldn't resist to talk about this incident. There is a chap named Peter Martin, Pirate Pete, who takes people on history tours. He claims descent from a pirate, Edward Morgan. And he teamed up with a Nigerian psychiatrist whom he met. And Peter Martin doesn't really care too much about historical chronology, but he's a Bristol guy who knows his Bristol families and goes out and finds ferrets around country houses. And I did team up and partner with him a bit. He did a slavery trail with Dr. Isi Ngwolo and Bristol slavery connections. And I think in one way it was worth doing because he found stuff out I never would have found. You know, local knowledge and connecting with people in your locality who know stuff is very good, but you do have to be academically rigorous about it. So I think I've got most of the mistakes out of his book, but not all. But it just shows, and what was fascinating about that liaison was that Dr. Ngwolo, she is a psychiatrist. She doesn't know about history, but she's descended from West African slave traders. And she was confronting her own history as well as Bristol's history. And that is a new development. I think the more that we can foster that kind of interaction and debate and discussion, the better it is. And it just shows you how globalization is affecting the way that we're addressing history. Now, the town trails, I did a town trail for Bristol Museum many years ago, and it's been endlessly plagiarized and used on various sites and used for teaching, et cetera. But I think the virtue of town trails, and the Bristol one isn't the only one, is that it does get students, A, to know their city, or their area, and B, to begin to unpack it and contextualize it in the larger global context. And so, I mean, this shows a building that's a folly that was built from the slag of brass. The millionaire who brought, so a very rich slave trader who was a Quaker, by the way, he built it from the slag of his brass mills, and it relates to the brass industry being an important component in the trade in slave-produced goods. What else do I want to say about that? I'm going to talk about the way family history and slavery can be unpacked in a bit, but I just want to turn to the idea of looking at black history through the medium of the American Civil Rights Movement, which, of course, with 12 Years a Slave and Selma and everything, is a very, you know, popular way into this. And I think there are dangers here as well as opportunities. You can have a very, this is just a lesson plan, and it can be very disconnected from the experience of, you know, British students to do a chronology of who Martin Luther King is, et cetera. And it becomes very sanitized in a hagiographic approach. One of the good things about the film Selma is that it showed some of the political bargaining and also the fact that it wasn't great man history, that there were a lot of civil rights workers, a lot of them women, people on the ground, community activists. There were huge ideological debates, et cetera, about the right way forward to achieve civil rights goals. But I think that there is a danger of teaching American civil rights movement in a very kind of formulaic way, which I think will turn students off. I've just become involved in a program called Journey to Justice. It's a charity, and you can look at journeytojustice.org. And they're a human rights organization that uses the American civil rights movement as a jumping-off point for British students to look at a history and to relate the way that the American civil rights movements can relate to similar questions in Britain. And they do so not just through a traveling exhibition, but through engaging students through drama and creative arts. And I think creative arts can grab students, and then they get them interested enough to unpack the more sustained historical research. And there are some students who, they've just had an exhibition, a traveling exhibition, which they're looking for venues. They're involving students in reenacting certain aspects of both British and American incidents in the civil rights movement and getting people to feel a sense of belonging and engagement in their history. So American civil rights movement is fine, but I think we need to make sure we don't make it into a great man history or a sanitized one that's disconnected from the very real concerns that young people in Britain have today about their lives. Another aspect of black history is to look at the black presence in Britain. And I did want to commend, I don't know how many of you know about BASA, the British Association for the Study of Black and Asian History. Have you not know? Well, I've got some websites here. They've done a lot of pioneering work on the black presence in Britain, and so their website is quite good. It's fairly polemical, but I think you can make your own judgments about that. Now, there are some problems about looking at the black presence. First of all, I was talking to my colleague Dean Smart in the education field at the University of the West of England, and a lot of the very good websites that you can get from the National Archive, BBC, etc., the funding's been withdrawn, they're being archived, they're not part of the sort of Gove agenda, so some of these are not being updated, and we have a disappearing fund of, there's a lot of web resources out there, but they're not always kept up to date, so you have to be quite mindful of it. And perhaps I'm missing the trick, that there may be some national compendium of up-to-date websites on black history, but I certainly haven't been able to find them. But there are some that are still quite interesting. But there have been some really good local initiatives, often thanks to the Heritage Lottery Fund. Thank God for the Heritage Lottery Fund. But they get lost and people don't know about them. There was a really good pamphlet on the history of black people in Devon that was published in a very accessible booklet. The History Detectives about black people in the West Midlands is another initiative that was really worthwhile. And it would be great to have some sort of project where all these different local history initiatives about the black presence are collated and recognized by those in education. Now, that brings me to something I was involved with that I think I mention it partly because it does highlight some of the problems of looking at the black presence as a way into the black presence in Britain as a way into black history. This was about 10 years ago. This is Tony Bannon and Paul Stevenson, who led the first black-led a protest against racial discrimination in England, and it was in 63 before the Racial Discrimination Acts came, when it was perfectly legal to not hire people because on the buses because they were black. And he led a group of mainly Jamaican, he's not Jamaican himself, but mainly Jamaican people, and then with white allies in Bristol and with Tony Benn's support, to overturn this. And it's been mooted that this helped to it gained international sort of attention. Sir Leary Constantine, the cricketer and diplomat, was involved. Harold Wilson was involved at the time, and it's been claimed that this helped to cause the Anti-Discrimination Act of 1965 and 1968. I think what I did in 1987 was I was intrigued by this story, which no one, you know, just heard on the grapevine, and I started interviewing both the trade unionists who had colluded in racial discrimination. A lot of people in the Bristol depots did not want black workers as bus drivers, et cetera. So it set up an intriguing contradiction between white trade unionists for international socialists and brotherhood and all that, not wanting black workers, and was that because of economic competition and fear, or was there racialism? I got interested, and I interviewed a bunch of people, and you can get my research, not the latest edition, but my research is online for free if you look at it. But Jane Hack, who's in the audience here, there's been a whole now industry really based on the Bristol bus boycott in terms of a Heritage Lottery bid, and the museum and some, is doing some schools curriculum work. Now it is, I don't know whether you want to sort of say a word or two about the project.
Okay, my name's Jane Hack. I'm Senior Learning Officer at Bristol Museums and Art Gallery. We've had funding from the Mayor's Office in Bristol and from Children and Young People's Services to produce some curriculum resources to teach children in the city about the bus boycott, because there are many children here and adults who don't know anything about it and it actually took place. So the curriculum resources will be for Key Stage 2 and Key Stage 3, and it also involved filming interviews between young activists in the city today with Paul Stevenson and other members of the original bus boycott, and he's sitting on a bus in our museum, M Shed, down on the harbour side. And we launched the resources in a couple of weeks' time, and the aim is to get them onto the Bristol Bus Boycott website, and it's up and running.
Right.
So anybody will be able to access them.
Right. So, I mean, I'm really thrilled that I was part of this, but on the other hand, there are certain caveats that I would like to say that we don't want to inflate. This is a great feel-good story, and we seize upon it. But we don't want to inflate the importance of it in the national and international context unduly. How typical was it? Did it really cause the civil rights movement? So it could be a great springboard for those sort of questions. But I think it needs to be treated with nuance and passion. But there's a lot of interest about it, and I think it's a great thing to. And there may be a BBC TV. A program about it. Idris Elba is evidently interested, so we shall see. But what I think is one of the more innovative challenges for black history and most exciting is to look at family history, both black and white, in relating to the history of slavery and the history of the black presence. And I want to just tell you about the example of Adrian Stone, who I met a few years ago. I was introduced to him by another scholar in Bristol, who's also Caribbean. And Adrian, who finished secondary school, didn't go on to university, was brought up in St. Paul's in Bristol, His mother got very ill, and he realized, he almost lost her but didn't, he realized he knew nothing about his family background. So he started doing family history. And because he's a smart guy and he's very technically savvy and good with social media and stuff like that, he started documenting his research, and it became an obsession. And he's been doing this unfunded for the last several years, okay? And what he did is he started to go to the Mormon Center for Family History, then it took him to the National Archives, and he found, A, that he had relatives in Bristol that he didn't know about, including people of Chinese and white descent, but people in London, and also, as he found out later, people in America. And this whole Robinson family tree, which isn't his name, but it's a related thing. He went to a family reunion there, all at his own expense. He went to Jamaica and found out the parish where his family had come from in the 60s, in the 50s and 60s, met cousins, etc. And because he knew, he had the sort of informal family contacts, he knew the nicknames of people, which helped him navigate the official genealogical sources and make connections. But everything was meticulously documented against documentary evidence. He also went to Scotland and the the archives there, and met the owner of the house of the guy who owned the plantation on which his ancestors were enslaved. So he's made all these amazing connections. But he was able, through his knowledge of people, his cousins, and to be able to navigate the archives in a way that conventionally trained academics might not have been able to do. And he found, I'm sorry I can't zoom this up, he found slave registers with the names of his ancestors, and he actually was able to, now let's see if I can do this to, yes, here we go. So you have, this is a return of a slave in the 19th century, late 18th and 19th century, plantation owners were forced to register their slaves as a limit on mortality and to start make people accountable. And so people were listed like chattel, like cattle, and so you have the names, I'm sorry, it's a bit blurry, and then their whether they were African or Creole, whether they were born in the West Indies or in Africa, and any remarks about them. And he found, let's see if I can see this, because these are, he let me have these slides. I think it might be the next one, but he's found various family members, and he shared his research with his relatives in Jamaica, which was great. What he's done, and I don't think it's on this one, but he actually traced his ancestry back to someone who was a woman who was called Igbo, which means she was born in West Africa, so she in the 1750s. And he's done a DNA test since, and that's connected him back to the West African coast. So it's a fantastic journey that takes on board Commonwealth immigration, the underdevelopment of Jamaica, slavery, the whole thing. And it was also a personally healing thing for him, but also it's something that children can relate to because it's about identity and belonging. And I think he should be funded. He's been asked to do this stuff, and he's very diffident. He's a great speaker, very diffident. But we should be trying to promote and fund these kind of, and finding out who else is doing this and how rigorous is their research. And certainly with white families with slavery connections. But of course, it's all very problematic, isn't it? Because I'll tell you one example with white people, but in terms of black people, there is this whole, the big elephant in the room is, slavery was traumatic. And to survive, you had to do stuff. And there was a lot of sexual exploitation in slavery, and so there's a lot of taboo subjects, and there's the impact that slavery had on the family structure, et cetera, meant that sometimes people's lineages, or there's multiple families, there's a different system of inheritance and marriage in the Caribbean, et cetera. So you're treading on eggshells sometimes with people's sensibilities to examine these areas, and teachers need to be cognizant of that. Nevertheless, what a fantastic way in to relating these big mega historical things with people's actual experience. And one of a colleague in Bristol, who's a therapist from Dominica, she's done a lot of therapy with Caribbean kids, and she's written, a really interesting pamphlet, which is about the trauma that people felt about when they came, a lot of kids who were left in the 1950s and 60s in the Caribbean, and their parents left to go to Britain and left them with grandparents or relatives and then brought them over 10 or 15 years later, often to already established families, and the trauma that caused them. But also, this trauma, which isn't unrelated to history, was exacerbated by the impact that slavery had on the disciplining of families within the Caribbean. And the kind of very, you know, Lenny Henry often jokes about this, but there's a very multi-layered psychological legacy about child rearing and family relationships to which one needs to be sensitive, and she's interviewed people about it. But the impact of migration on family relations is another unspoken aspect of Black history, which I think is an interesting one. God knows how you're going to deal with that one in the classroom. That was play Muscovado, which has just been touring now, which I thought was really good at unpacking the very nuanced gender and class and race relations under the regime of slavery. Now, when we're looking at the Black presence, how do we, in Britain particularly, because not many Black people were in Britain before the mass immigration in the 50s and 60s. So how do we look at the Black presence in Britain as a means without over-egging it, and how do we find out about it? Because often the people coming as servants, sailors, casual workers into Britain during the days of slavery and in the 19th century went unrecorded, like most poor people, because most of them were poor. There are archives, and this is one from the Autograph Studio in London, but a lot of them are not contextualized. So how do we use the visual evidence? And is the kind of history we do dictated by the visual evidence we can find? In other words, is it skewed and distorted because we can only talk to the pictures that survive? And of course, that's a problem that all historians have, but it's a particular problem with Black history. And there's been some really interesting studies by Gemma Romain and Carolyn Bressy about looking at the Bernardo's archives, which has Black people there. Often Black people are overrepresented in court records, so you get a skewed idea that the only Black people there were criminals and that kind of thing. So you have to be very careful about not just being guided by the evidence that survives to get a whole sort of picture about what Black people were doing. There's so much to say about this, but I mean, Jan Marsh, who's a curator, has done a lot of work and has curated exhibition in the National Portrait Gallery. They did a great exhibition about some of the more prominent Black people who were writers and intellectuals and anti-slavery campaigners in the 18th and 19th century. And again, you know, the museums, if you're in a particular locale, liaise with make friends with your archivist, your librarian, your curator, because they often have done a lot of, and your local history groups, because this is where the untold riches can be excavated and brought to the national arena. Looking at visual imagery, we've just had a very interesting session on excavating or interrogating a picture of a procession, the Durbar, in 1903 in India, in Delhi. I've had a wonderful experience of being asked to curate and do a tour of slavery-related paintings at Tate Britain last spring. And it really does make you, I teach the history of slavery, so I'm really fascinated by the way visual evidence that does survive can be interrogated. This is an 18th century picture of St. James's Park, but there are, you'll just notice, and often you don't notice, that there is a Black presence, often domestic servants, but sometimes people of fashion as well in there. And so, but the important thing is to really set that particular specific painting or visual evidence in context. And so one of the pictures that I looked at was by Robert Benjamin Hayden. It's called May Day. It was in the 1820s, and it was about a London chimney sweeps festival. And you have a chimney sweep here who's blacked up, if you can see him, and a green man, and it's an old sort of festival that it happens in May, and the only evidence of the Black presence is this chap here who's a Black coachman who looks above and rather down on the blacked up chimney sweep, who is, you know, a symbol of British poverty. All sorts of interesting questions here. But what was really fascinating to me is when I started to research this painting and this artist, I found out that he had a black a model in 1810, Robert Wilson, of whom more later, whom he used, that he was a racialist, this artist. He published racialist views. He thought that the black artist that he met, whom he used as a model, not for this painting, but for others, and many other artists used, was a evidence of the missing link in evolution, okay? He was incredibly racialist. And then by the 1840s, he paints a picture of the anti-slavery convention that met in London, which had black figures there. And by then, having met other black people, he became converted to the anti-slavery cause in America and repudiated his racialist theories. There's a whole very complicated story, but it's a fascinating journey just by looking at this one piece of evidence, what one can find. And it made me connect to this chap. When I was doing an article on slavery in public statuary in London, I went to the Westminster Abbey, and this is a detail. I'm sorry, I thought I had the note. This is a detail of the monument to Charles James Fox, a radical politician who was associated with the anti-slave trade campaign. And so this very fat Charles James Fox is shown in a toga reclining, you know, dying, and he's being attended to by the kneeling slave. Now, there's all sorts of stuff you can say about it. It's really interesting to unpack for racial attitudes. But this man was the Wilson that Robert Benjamin Hayden used as a model. He was a real person, and he was used by lots, and he's evidence of the black presence, that there were people. He was a former sailor who acted as an artist model for a number of British artists. So by trying to connect up these different sources, you begin to get continuities and a little glimpse into the small black community, perhaps 3,000 or 4,000 by the end of the 18th century, in London at the time. How much time do I have there? It's when do we end? At 1 o'clock. All right. So it is. Oh my gosh, I have
10 past.
Okay.
13:10.
All right. This is another fascinating picture, a military picture of the Battle of Jersey. It's got a black person. It's a death of Major Pearson, who's being shot by a French sniper. But there's this black guy here, who's dressed differently than the red coats around. And if we look at him, he is painted as a member of the Royal Ethiopian Regiment. This takes us to the whole story about black loyalists in America who were put into, some of whom were put into a regiment to fight with the British. They were promised if they fought with the British, these are slaves, that they would be given their freedom. Some of them were. They fled after the American Revolution. They went to Canada. Some of them ended up in Sierra Leone. Some of them in London. There's a whole story there that when you unpack that picture, you can find out, and it's an absolutely fascinating one that I'm afraid I don't have time to go into. The other interesting thing about looking at the black presence in Britain is that it doesn't stop with the emancipation of enslaved Africans in the British colonies in 1834. It also, there's an engaging black presence of black visitors, black campaigners who visit Britain and do tours to promote the anti-slavery cause in America and the anti-lynching campaign in the 1880s, because there's so much lynching in America by the 1880s and 90s. And so there's an interaction between white liberals in Britain and black activists. And so you had people like Frederick Douglass, the famous anti-slavery campaigner and freed slaves, Ida B. Wells in the 1890s with the anti-lynching campaign, who came here. And that painting tells this interesting story in itself, because it was about an escape, a couple who were escaping slavery in America in the 1850s. Well, what does it have to do with Britain? Well, it was by an artist who the painting was donated to Liverpool, because it was donated to help the Lancashire cotton workers during the Civil War, because they suffered because there was an embargo on the trade in cotton during the Civil War. And so he was trying to make the connection between the exploitation of black people and the exploitation of white workers during the Civil War. And so there's a very interesting story. And there's all sorts of fascinating characters, male and female, who come to campaign against slavery, who are African-American, to come to Britain. So, again, I think that's a whole area. So, and then these family histories that we don't know much about. This is from a photographic archive, but it just shows you that there are these things that we need to contextualize. I'll just finish with the need to make joined-up thinking between what's happening in the Caribbean, what's happening in America, what's happening in Africa. Often you have histories that are, you know, locally based, either in America or Britain, and they don't connect up. There's a charity, a scholarship in a Bristol school, Queen Elizabeth Hospital, the Gist Hospital. The Queen Elizabeth Hospital. Gist was a young charity school guy who went off to Virginia as an indentured servant, worked on a tobacco plantation, married the wife of the plantation owner when she was widowed, became very rich slave owner, freed his slaves. You would never know it from any of this. Now, what happened was when he freed his slaves, they couldn't be free in Virginia in those days because it was 1808, so he gave them small holdings in Ohio, very impoverished, wild Ohio. Some of them went back to Virginia because they were starving to death and became slaves again. But some of them held out, and there are their names. This is a memorial that's just been put up. And through the wonders of Google, I managed to get a hold of the descendants of the Gist slaves who still meet, and who up until a generation ago were living on those small holdings in great poverty. And so we've made this connection. And we also had the Gist family, who no longer own slave plantations, but they had a nice country house up until the 50s. They also have a family history. And they came to the talk I gave about this group, but they didn't want to meet the descendants of the Gist slaves. They were too scared that they might be asked for reparations or something. So racialism and fear still plays its role, but it's just fascinating that we have, that the other story behind this is that these memorials, which were put up by the descendants of the Gist slaves, were vandalized just before the election for Obama, and they had to replace it. So, the legacy of slavery still lives on in all sorts of weird and wonderful ways. The final story is about West Africa, this lady here, Silu Pasco, who came to a few of my talks, and I was talking about internationalizing the history of the black presence. She is of Dutch, British, and African Ghanaian ancestry, and she started to reach. She's gone back to Ghana doing family history, found out she was descended in part from Dutch administrators of one of the slave forts on the West African coast, but also there's connections with the Akan royal family and slave trading and all sorts of interesting connections, and she's pursuing a family history. And I just think this is fascinating stuff that I hope we can build on and consolidate and ultimately translate into lesson plans and mainstream into the curriculum. And the other thing is that a lot of these heritage sites in Africa are just dying because they don't have any capital. And they need support, and there could be great sort of joint projects with school kids and links through Skype and fundraising, crowdfunding, to help preserve some of these initiatives. Also links with American museums. The Colonial Williamsburg site is a fantastic site where there's reenactments, a huge site. And I was out there, I did research out there, and there was a reenactment where this gal who she played a real person who was the descendant of an Irish and African, a free Irish woman and an African slave, and it emerged that the miscegenation laws, the anti-racial interracial marriage laws, which were enacted in the lifetime in the 17th century to stop white and blacks getting together against white landowners, were in force in America till the 1960s, and so it sort of brings the history up to date. Underfunded Gambian Museum, again with links to America and to Britain, but I think we should make liaison with some of these underfunded museums in both the Caribbean and West Africa, and I think that would be very enriching. We have to really be careful about losing some of the archival research that's already been done. but you can still sort of see the archive versions of this, and I have some useful websites that I've found, so I'll leave that up if you want to take some notes. So I hope I've given you some food for thought about different ways that one might approach Black history and some of the potential. It's kind of depressing to give this talk in a political atmosphere where you know there's not going to be a lot of funding for this. But I think a lot could be done with local initiatives and networking with the people who have expertise in your area, both in the curatorial and academic sense, but also in family history senses, both Black and white family histories. Anyways, thank you very much. Are there any? I'd be welcome for any feedback I'd welcome any feedback or questions that you might have. Yes, gentlemen, first.
On reparations at the very end. Do you think it's suitable for teaching in schools or undergraduate level? And how do you think it would be done for historians?
Well, it's politically explosive, the reparations thing. I think there's a lot of debate within the Black so-called community, between Africans, West Africans and African Caribbeans. It's very politically, explosive. So, do it with care. I certainly think at undergraduate level, where you're distanced from some of those political pressures, it would be a suitable thing because it's a way in to explore some of these human rights issues. The problem with doing local and global contextualization is you need to know about your local history. Then you need to know about your national history. And then the global. I was an external for a local global master's degree at Sheffield Hallam. And it's very complicated to have a handle on all those three levels of history. So I think the more specific you can be about a local thing and then look at the wider implications, kind of the better, but keep it grounded and specific in the evidence. But yes, I think how can you avoid it? On the other hand, people do need to have a basic, I'm kind of Govian in the sense that they do need to have a basic chronology about stuff and know some of the major actors before they can pronounce with any nuance or sophistication about some of these ethical issues. I hope that answers your question. Gentleman in the back.
I wondered if you had a view on the discovery and arguments that History Matters, the History Matters Project, has identified, that there is simply an overwhelming lack of opportunity for Black undergraduates to go on to become history teachers. I mean, last year's stats from Hefty was at 1,800 postgraduate opportunities awards. There were only 3 Black Afro-Caribbean students. So there isn't the Black presence in our schools.
That's partly because of an instrument, people go into law or business where they feel they can get a career, if they're going to make the sacrifice. I think one of the things that I was very proud of UWE did some time ago was we actually had a bursary. It was a positive action bursary for someone in Black history, and we couldn't sort of say Black students, but that was the subtext, frankly. And we were able to mentor someone who, and a lot of Black kids from poor areas, like white working class boys, are under immense pressure not to sell out or, to better themselves in that individualistic way. And so they have to really be supported through in order to feel validated and the financial implications of taking on these degrees. So I think positive action would be a great thing to do, but I think you have to, be even-handed about it. Of course, we would love to see more Black people in here. How we do it in a cold climate is a difficult one. I don't know whether other people have views on that.
I think that's where hopefully the HA is going to try and provide resources and encouragement, but also communicate with constituencies within schools, and in particular with Black parents. I mean, we know that Black history in the community is enormously popular.
Yeah, it is, and it's so important that you have a good, rigorous evidence base to inject into that popular discourse. And yeah, I agree with you on that. And it's a whole other conversation.
Yeah.
Can I? Yes.
Where do you think slavery should appear in the school curriculum in England? Because usually it's
I don't know enough about the structure of secondary school history teaching to answer that. I have to, I can't pronounce, but I do think what I think is, it's all been reduced to this thing about should we apologize about the slave trade and all that, which is so unproductive. What we do need to do is to acknowledge the labor of people, whose exploited labor has helped make this country what it was in its day, its heyday, the architectural heritage, to acknowledge the exploitation that went on, both of blacks and whites. And so slavery is part of that story. Now, when I say that, I'm generalizing so that, you know, you can't just sort of say, oh, it's just like, you know, the white working class. It isn't. I mean, slavery is a different thing. You're a chattel. You have no rights. You're not considered a human being. It is different in intensity and scope and scale. So I think it should be included, definitely. But I couldn't really comment at what stage you would do that, because I just don't have the expertise that you have in secondary education or primary education. I'm sorry not to be more informative.
Yeah. Madge, I think the problem in the school context is actually time as much as
yes.
anything. And the difficulty of avoiding the fairy story and engaging with real life, because the story of slavery is a story of some triumphs and yes. the bus boycotts and things like
yeah.
that, civil rights. There's a campaign because things are bad, and then suddenly they've achieved what they wanted,
yeah.
so everything's all right then, isn't it?
Mm.
And we know perfectly well it isn't.
Yes, and I mean, I think you know, it's been brought up in these history debates that there isn't enough time to teach history. So I guess one of the, you know, the Historical Association is lobbying for more time. How do you get nuance into it without putting people off? You need to engage their emotions, their aspirations. And black history is such a hot topic, and identity and belonging, such a live topic amongst particularly black students and students of mixed heritage. It's so poignantly, you know, because I see it with the few undergraduates I have from those backgrounds. It's so important for them. But I don't, you know, until we have these structural changes, I think what we need to do, what we can do at the moment, pragmatically, is just make sure that we liaise, those of us who are interested, liaise with groups, not just in the academy, but outside the academy, keep personal networks going, and pool the information we have about what's available, what's out there, and what's good. Because a lot of young people now go to the social media, and they're very good at getting stuff, but they're not really good at interrogating it critically. Anything else? I hope that was of interest. Thank you very much for your attention.